that the future's in pretty good hands when I hear the testimony that just preceded mine. Thank you. Sorry for going over.
Bob, I think if you think back to some of the stuff that has gotten built in the last 20 years, it's stuff that really made us proud and, to me, really captured that vision. I live not far from downtown Sellwood, and if you think about the nice project that Lauren Waxman built there with ground floor retail that includes a library branch and I believe 10 townhouse units above it, or the some of the other similar projects that he built in Inner Southeast. To me, that's archetypical of what we had in mind when we created the mixed-use zoning tool and did a lot of the planning work that you've been involved in, you know, to get this vision turned into a map and code. Frankly, I didn't envision 40 to 80 unit apartment projects on half acre or acre sites on these main streets. Did you?
Mr. Mayor, yeah. The difference, I think, is that we had different expectations, perhaps, about the number of apartments that would be in those buildings. But I thought buildings of the size that, perhaps not the design, but the size that Mr. Sackhoff, I believe his name is, has put at 37th and Division, were clearly consistent with the zoning map and the comp plan designations. The idea that there would be very small apartments and therefore there would be 80 of them instead of something like 40 or 45 or 50 is a change from what expectations we had then. I'd point out, though, in the same breath, that for every design that raises concerns, another building, in this case four blocks away, designed by Thomas Hacker and Associates, is going up on a small internal lot on the north side of Division. You wouldn't want to have two curb cuts to serve that building. It has, I don't know how many units, but it's going to be a more attractive addition to the neighborhood. It's going to fit into an ensemble on that block. It's not going to stand out like a sore thumb. I'd also point out that Homer Williams, PDC, and a whole bunch of other actors were able to build a certain number of towers in an area like South Waterfront, and then the market ended. The market may end for reasons completely unrelated to zoning designations on Division Street, on Fremont, at any time. It may be a bubble. We all know that there will be starts and stops and that different architects, different designers, and different needs will be met in those remaining lots in the future. And that's a good thing, to have a city build, if it must be in spurts, but to be built sequentially and not all at once. And this scale, particularly these internal block, mid-block buildings of around 40 units, you don't want to be chopping up those blocks to provide parking with curb cuts.
Bob, can I follow up on that for a sec?
Your Honor, you're asking some really technical questions of people, and I'm no longer a code guy, but I'll give it a shot.
You're our honored guest who was there at the beginning, so I think you could help us fill in some gaps. But so you've now successfully run for office, and you've been to lots of these meetings throughout the community where we talk about the deal we struck about an urban growth boundary and protecting farmland and doing something unique and placing density where it belonged within the urban growth boundary. And we always highlight, for example, places like South Waterfront and the River District, and we say, or the Lloyd District, and we say, here's places where we want to, through our zoning code, encourage mixed-use development, big buildings, lots of units. And I think what we've achieved in the River District is quite miraculous, actually.
It's amazing.
And with the opening of the fields coming up, it'll even get better. But we kind of either explicitly or implicitly told some of our traditional R5 neighborhoods that if we did it smart, we could protect those neighborhoods.
Yes.
Now, we've had the fight about infill within those neighborhoods.
Yes.
And we've had the fight about skinny houses and all kinds of things. But I wonder, in this debate where I've heard people say that at both wings, we've had people testify that density is a bad thing, and others who've said that density is the holy grail. I wonder whether, at least in the context of the kinds of corridors we're talking about, there isn't a chance to have some balance without sacrificing our values. And I say that because, you know, as someone who spends a lot of time on Division, for example, likes to go to those restaurants, has friends who live around there, it strikes me that it is a slightly different case when you have R5 neighborhoods on the wings, a block away from those corridors, then the areas where we always preach, we would like to put density, South Waterfront, River District, and the like. And a second distinguishing characteristic to me is that people bought their homes a long time ago with one set of expectations, and now we're changing quite significantly the ground rules. Whereas anybody who moves into the River District and South Waterfront who complains about density probably didn't visit the area before they bought. So, comment?
Commissioner Fish, I won't wag my finger at you, but we didn't change the rules. You're talking about changing the rules. The rules since 1990 have been that mixed-use four-story development without parking is permitted on certain main streets with the commercial storefront designation. And the rule since about 2000, since then-Commissioner, now Mayor Hales, liberalized those provisions to apply them to additional locations with good transit service. Those are longstanding rules. No homeowner, no typical homeowner, goes and surveys and researches the zoning code in great detail before making a purchase. I get that. We do need to protect the R5 zoned lands that abut the main streets. We need to protect them from the parking impacts of development, whether or not you require 25% or 30% parking in the buildings. Because absent some kind of management of the parking supply on the street, people will rent a unit but not pay extra to rent a parking space if that's what's required. And so the builder will have to push that cost onto the units. You won't be able to avoid that. You won't have a market in parking. And that impact, losing that space near your home that you've enjoyed as a longtime resident of Richmond, is something that the city council ought to work to protect. You ought to do it by assigning value to those spaces and ensuring that people recognize that value by putting meters, as others have suggested, on the main street itself. And having a firm line between the areas that are entitled to make use of that parking district because they're zoned R5 or residential, and the areas that are zoned mixed use and are being built under a different set of rules and probably shouldn't be entitled to make use of the parking district on the same terms as renters or owners in the existing R5 zones.
So as someone earlier said, maybe less a disagreement about ends but more about means.
Absolutely. The single-family neighborhoods abutting the main streets are some of the beneficiaries of the main streets. I'm one of those folks. But I'll have fewer benefits, fewer services, less frequent transit service if we don't augment the capacity for people to live and consume and commute by transit or bike in our neighborhoods by building on the main streets as well as filling in our side yards in the single-family neighborhood.
Bob, at least in the privacy of this chamber.
Yes, on TV.
Where this council has consistently supported things like urban growth boundaries and aspirational goals around the environment, can we really not find an agreement where there's a reasonable balance that doesn't do violence to our values? Can't we allow neighborhoods to petition to have the kind of regulated parking which they're allowed to?
You bet.
And at the same time put in minimum parking requirements so that we build a modest capacity in these areas to be used by either residents or businesses or others without doing violence to the value? I mean, I understand, I appreciate the purity of your position, but is there no give here without doing violence to the vision that you've had for 40 years?
Commissioner, I speak as a resident of Richmond, as a consumer of the Division Main Street, as someone who wants more neighbors, who will share the values that long-term residents have shared, who will respect the fact that a lot of the long-term residents expect to be able to park on their neighborhood streets and will find ways to accommodate their parking consistent with that need. And as I said in my note that I circulated to members of the council last week because I didn't think I could be here, I think what the Planning and Sustainability Commission did, at your insistence, was develop a pretty reasonable compromise.
Can I ask you a question about the narrow issue of whether developers should be allowed to fulfill part of the parking requirement with off-site parking? Your take on the balance between Commissioner Fritz's concern that that would lock in surface parking and my concern that if we don't allow that, we'll be requiring people to build parking that might not be necessary?
Counselor, Commissioner, I'm really a counselor, you are a commissioner. I share Commissioner Fritz's concern that good housing stock or other good buildings could be removed to create parking. One of the sore spots of getting a Nature's was that some houses were torn down to provide surface parking back then. I wouldn't want that to happen as a consequence of allowing off-site. Where there are parking spaces available, reusing those would seem to be a reasonable step. And, I understand that could have greater consequences than perhaps Planning and Sustainability Commission intended by making its recommendation, but I think we should not incentivize teardowns and more asphalt, absolutely.
So existing parking would be a different story.
Shared parking.
Shared parking is great. And Commissioner, that would be one other benefit of regulating parking on the street. You create a market incentive to share and charge for that shared parking.
One last question. Professor Liberty gave us some suggestions about how to incentivize affordable housing. Would you care to offer your perspective?
Yeah. I wish I didn't have this headache. Commissioner Fish, you hit the nail on the head by mentioning not only inclusionary zoning and the state prohibition on it, but the exception from the prohibition for, if you will, voluntary inclusionary zoning, that is incentivized inclusionary zoning.
We can't, I don't think we can upzone in the, right, in this area.
Well.
You may not, we, maybe?
You are the city council.
I understand, but let's, okay, so what are the...
No, my point is, if you wish to incentivize, for example, permanent affordable housing, whether it's 60 years or Professor Liberty's longer term permanent standard, you could say to a developer, you could reduce the required parking from the 25%, which the Planning and Sustainability Commission has recommended and which I reluctantly support, over 40. You could reduce from that level to the extent you are providing affordable, guaranteed affordable housing. That would be a way of incentivizing and then, in essence, requiring additional affordability.
And getting around the preemption.
Yes, exactly. And you could also do that through upzoning techniques that took into consideration bonuses for permanently affordable housing.
Our tax abatements are 10 years. Our regulatory agreements are 60. We could work out those details. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, I think we need staff back up here. So a number of issues have come up. Maybe you want to take one of the simplest ones first, and that is historic buildings.
So we were thinking that we could take that, and if there are any other additional amendments, and be able to put those together for the next
meeting. We want you to do it tonight, please.
Okay. Currently, the exemption, we can do that. We can do an exemption for adaptive reuse of historic buildings, and that's not...
That would be just what I would move, that we provide an exemption for adaptive reuse of historic buildings.
And what we're saying by historic buildings, we mean designated landmarks or contributing structures. So that's what we would come back with. Those are the two sort of official kind of statuses you might have.
So moved.
Second. Okay, that amendment is on the table as well.
So we've had a lot of creative ideas for how we could work some affordability into the current code, but I think, frankly, the devil's in the details, figuring out what kind of units we want to incentivize, what the trigger is, and then there's the possibility legislature will lift the preemption sooner rather than later. So what's a reasonable timeline to come up with some proposals we could consider to tweak the bonus system to build in some affordability?
It's just a workload issue, honestly. There are several approaches. One of the basic things you need to figure out is if providing a parking space costs X amount, either in how much it costs to construct it, in the land value, or how much you lose because you don't have a unit, what's that worth to somebody compared to the cost that would be foregone by providing an affordable unit for 60 years? So then we can actually run the math of saying how many spaces would it take to actually show the result. That kind of analysis we can do relatively quickly. And we've actually have been talking with the Bureau of Housing in the development of this proposal about linking it to the limited tax exemption kind of status, too, because there's clearly a building that's got a commitment to affordability that we could take a development cost off of if we considered a buy down for that.
So if I could just, Mayor, if we could have a commitment coming out of this hearing that we'll bring the Planning Bureau, Housing, whoever else together to look at question that Mr. Wood raised as to some barrier, some potential barrier in our existing LTE programs that make it less likely that the private developers are using it, or he said some glitch. Now, we just did the big look.
Right.
But I'd like to understand from home builders why it's not being used, why the TOD is not being used more frequently in those areas, because that is one existing tool.
Before we go any farther, I think our city attorney has some advice for us because she has her microphone on.
I do. Getting back to the historic amendment, if you are going to adopt that amendment tonight, you need to have actual language to adopt. You can't just adopt a concept.
No, we haven't adopted anything. We just have a whole series of amendments on the table at this point.
But for the others, Mayor, we do have the specific language.
Right, for the others, we have language.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But which ones we can actually act on today are...
Okay, it wasn't clear to me whether you were hoping to actually have that language to adopt tonight.
No, I was hoping to have it adoptable by next week.
Yes.
That possible? That works.
That's doable.
That works.
Okay.
Thank you.
So Joe, just to make sure we're tracking, is there some fix to our existing LTE programs which would make them more user-friendly in this context? Is there some way we can take the good advice we've had during this hearing about some voluntary measures that would create affordability, including through the bonus scheme or some other? And I would, if we can get a commitment to take that up, that is the kind of fine-tuning that I think we ought to come back at some point to discuss. And I realize within a week it's unlikely we'll have that. So.
Right.
Not within a week.
I mean, it could be a couple months, and we're happy to work with Housing to come up with
that.
Our real fear is that we don't want to come up with something that doesn't do anything.
Right.
You know, you don't want to come up with a policy that says, you know, you can get rid of one parking space for two units if it's an affordable unit, but no one's going to take it up because it's not cost effective to do that.
Agreed. And so also the countervailing concern that I have is that as we continue to build out this capacity, if we're not salting these buildings, new development with some affordability, we'll never get it back.
Absolutely.
And then we'll be pricing a whole class of people out of these neighborhoods.
Right.
And that's wholly inconsistent with our Portland plan.
Hasn't your findings about bonuses been they're largely ineffective in terms of achieving the policy goals that we hope to achieve with bonuses?
In the central city where we have most of the bonuses, that has been true. But the reason is because of not doing this kind of math we just talked about. You know, you have to calibrate how much a bike locker is worth to the value of the square feet you get for it. In this case, you need to calibrate the cost and value of less parking to how much affordability it might apply. And we can try to run that kind of math to tell you if there's a business case.
Yeah, that's what I would urge. I mean, I would back up from this and say, you know, are we talking about realistic trade-offs that are made by developers? Are we talking about things that we think developers make trade-offs about? And I'm not sure parking and affordability are really
well, and
real
I think
trade-offs.
That's what Commissioner Fish is asking us to look at. So.
Commissioner Fritz, since you introduced a bunch of amendments earlier, I didn't know whether one of your amendments dealt with the question that a member of the Disability Commission raised about accessibility from the street or parking could you address that?
Thank you. That was the very first testify of the Chair of the Commission on Disability talking about loading zones. And it sounded we're requiring loading spaces on site for now 40 units rather than 50 units. Is there also the capacity to have PBOT require on street loading zones for apartment uses?
Here comes Rob Birchfield to help.
Thank you, Rob Birchfield.
Thank you.
Perfect.
Rob Birchfield, transportation, city traffic engineer. So let's first distinguish there would be on-site loading, which would be, i.e., loading if you have your small moving van and you need a place to unload on-site, that would be a loading site. Then there'd be like a disabled space, which could be on street or it could be on site. If you provide any parking on site, then the requirements for providing a disabled space would kick in, and there would be a disabled loading space on site if there's any parking. If there was no parking at all in the apartment development, then the apartment owner, the apartment manager could request that we put in a disabled zone if they have users that need a disabled zone, and we would be responsive to that if we can. Most cases we can respond. There's some cases where you might have a street that doesn't have any parking lane. Let's say it's a Southeast 39th or something like that, in which case there would be no place to put the disabled space. You know, we'd look on a side street, et cetera. We would problem solve and try to and meet those users' needs. I wouldn't recommend necessarily, I don't think it would be a good construct to require the developer to require PDOT to do something, because essentially we may not have the ability to do it. The developer can't control what we can do, and we may be constrained.
So what do developments and apartment dwellers currently do if there's 39 or currently 49 apartments and there isn't a loading space? Where does the moving truck park?
Well, I mean, look, that issue basically happens almost everywhere. Any like interstate moving van that's moving multiple, you know, moves in one load is going to park on street, and that's how they're going to unload. And they can reserve space in advance if they feel the need to. You know, if it's a constrained environment, they can come to us and get a permit to reserve that space in advance so that they have a place to come into. That's, you know, sort of the temporary management of the right-of-way and things that you have to do when you get into more intensively used environments.
So in a situation where somebody with a disability who is van dependent is moving into one of these apartments which doesn't require parking, that resident could ask for a disabled spot to be put on the street?
Yes.
Does that address your concern, Commissioner Fisher?
My hunch is it probably addresses the concern of at least two people who testified, but I'd want to know more about mechanically how that works. Since you're here, though, can I ask you another question?
Well, Yes. Before you move from that, I just want to put on note that we've had several discussions of loading spaces in various recaps and other situations, and it's something that I'm hoping is another thing to put on the list for the comprehensive plan revisions. Sorry, go ahead.
So, Rob, we've had a number of people testify this afternoon that another way to address this problem is through parking management. And would you just remind us what is the mechanism that any neighborhood can trigger to actually begin that process? Because my understanding, it's a citizen-initiated, it's a citizen or neighborhood-initiated process.
Yeah, right. Right now we have a pilot program on the books where people could petition to start a permit, an area permit program for their small neighborhood area. There are limitations to what you could accomplish with that, because it's permitting users within that area. It's not pricing parking per se, and it's not really going very far at all towards managing demand, I wouldn't say. I mean, some of the ideas that have come up, you know, with benefit districts, you know, larger district-wide efforts, I think there's good ideas out there. I think we need to clarify our policy goals and objectives around how we want to manage parking and to whose benefit, because there's a lot of different competing needs out there, obviously. I mean, we're working through some of these issues with Northwest, where, I mean, you have the needs of the retailers, their visitors, traded off against the needs of the residents, employees of those businesses, and you have all those things in these centers and corridors going on. You have a lot of different parking demands. So we kind of need to make sure that we have a good policy framework for what outcomes we want to support. It isn't just a residential issue.
Okay.
I have some questions about where this applies that was raised by the folks who talked about the EX zone, and about the hierarchy of what trumps in the zoning code, and in particular about tables 266.1-1 and -2. So my understanding is that it does apply in the EX zone, and that would mean that in the EX zone near transit, we would currently it's required one space per two units, and it would go down to one space for three units for your typical EX large house, large apartment building.
Based on the tiered approach, yeah.
So let that be shown to those who think that we're doing away with Portland as we know it, that this actually makes it, gives less parking in some of the EX, the high density developments near transit, but it still wouldn't apply in the central city, right?
You're correct.
Okay, but it does apply in EX zoning elsewhere, so that if we support appropriate parking, that's a good thing. My next question, though, is in the R zones, the R20 through R2, R1. Mm-hmm. Does it apply there?
R20, a single dwelling zone?
For the single dwelling zones, it's if it trumps table 266-2, for household living, we currently require one parking space per unit. Mm-hmm. Would this mean that in the single family zones, we would no longer be requiring one off-street parking per unit? And maybe Rebecca Rizzo needs to help us with this one. Or
Rebecca
Phil.
Can correct me. If we still would be unless it's within 500 feet right. of the frequently operated
But within 500 feet of a frequent transit, Phil is helping us out here. I want to make sure that we're not having any unintended consequences from this fix. And we've talked a lot about apartments, and I haven't heard any discussion about off-street parking for a single family. It could be that in this case, the market would require that most new single family residences are going to have parking.
The development, whether it's a single family house or a duplex or anything under 30 units, wouldn't be required to have parking if they're within 500 feet of the frequently operating bus line.
Right, because they're not below the size threshold.
Which is the same as current.
So that, I think, is something for us to think about between now and next week as to whether that was the intent to change the single family zones as well.
No, it's not a change.
It's already that way.
Sorry. It's already that way?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Thank you. I don't think I have any further questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, Joe, please.
Yes, there's one data point I wanted to just put out there because I think it might help give some context and take a little of the pressure off. Remember, today, even with zero minimum parking in some parts of town, over the last 6 years, 65% of the new units that have been built have provided parking.
Right.
And those units have provided it almost at a ratio of 1 per DU. So the only reason I offer that up is that over the weeks of listening to the debate, we really do pay close attention and express great concern about meeting the needs of all these different kind of households and all these kind of situations. The whole policy was to allow not just, to create those opportunities. 65% of the units are out there that one could choose to live in that have parking. The rest are apartments without parking. So by having the policy we've had over the years, we've created two different channels of choice, and that choice is often in the same neighborhood, too. So as you all are playing with the ratios and the like, it's not the end of all that choice. You're calibrating it to that. But you may not have to go as far in making the requirements reach as deeply into the number of units and the size of buildings that are affected because so much parking is already provided by the market. There are those market-fed providing choices out there.
Mayor, if I could, one other housekeeping matter before we start taking up amendments. I've asked council to give us a written opinion to Mr. Ramos's April 4th letter, which mm-hmm. raises a statutory question, and ask that we have that before next week's hearing.
Okay.
So we understand the argument and the city's view as to that argument. So,
great.
Thank you.
Helpful. Thank you. So, Commissioner Novick.
Joe, I wanted to ask you a question about the issue of off-site parking. I know that the commission additionally proposed allowing the parking requirements to be met by the use of off-site parking. The commission also proposed that the cutoff would be 40 units, and Commissioner Fish has proposed cutting that down to 30. And as you can tell, I've sort of been wrestling with the question of Is Commissioner Fritz's concern about locking in surface parking a big enough concern that we shouldn't go into that whole issue of offsite parking, or is it worthwhile to allow, I mean, should we think about allowing developers to use some offsite parking? And I was thinking of offering an amendment that for the 30 to 40 unit buildings, you could allow the requirement to be met with offsite parking, thinking, well, there might be 6 to 8 spaces lying around and why not use them? So I just wanted your thoughts on that.
When the Planning and Sustainability Commission discussed this, they grappled with it too, because we do have a history of having these kind of reverse incentives of promoting tearing down houses. And so it's a fear. We don't like to do that. When we looked at the land value in the places where this development is happening, the conclusion was that seemed very unlikely because it's just more valuable as development. You're seeing the parking lots on Division being redeveloped for projects. So that's where the commission's logic ran with that. And then, as I said earlier, they were really interested in also opening the door so that you could secure spaces in another structured parking that's part of another building and optimize it that way. I can't guarantee that wouldn't happen, but our conclusion was that was not that there was more value in providing the flexibility than it overweighed the concern about whether or not this would create an incentive for teardowns. And by targeting that 31 to 40 unit building group, remember that we've heard a variety of different arguments for why that's a hard building size to develop, apparently. Like, it sounds like it's difficult. Access, lot size, you're really squeezing a lot on. We heard from, as part of our discussions, you cross this threshold about whether or not you have an on-site manager. When you're in the 40 and above, or 41 and above, it's a big building. It's got a different economics. That's what our research showed as well. So anything we do to make it easier to develop in that 31 to 40 kind of building model probably does provide some valuable flexibility to, getting infill development. And if providing off-site parking took some pressure off of the concern that we're going to start chopping up the street with curb cuts, which I think is a legitimate concern, that's not a desirable outcome too, then that would be valuable. That was a long answer, but I think it's, in the net, it would be valuable to give the 31 to 40 cohort as much of a break as we can.
Does it count as commercial parking or residential parking?
The way the code is written, Commissioner, it has to allow parking on it. So it has to be a commercially zoned property, if that's what you're asking.
And so it would be essentially taking a commercially zoned property that could otherwise be a mixed-use development and making it into a parking lot.
No, well, it would be taking probably more likely a parking lot and buying part of it, or taking a parking in a building that's being underutilized and buying part of that. And so securing it that way, you couldn't, and so both of those are commercial sites in the future. So you've got a parking lot, part of it's owned by this building across the street, part of it's just commercial parking. Somebody wants to develop that lot and they're going to make more money. Just the economics of developing that site now include the need, if you're going to assemble the site, to replace the parking that the building across the street owns. So as they build parking into the building, there could be an economic reason for them to include it in that building. So you're getting your structured building supply at a later date that way.
Yeah, I'm not so concerned about the shared use. I'm concerned about surface parking lots. So what would be the regulations as far as buffer to adjacent residential zones? Would it be counted as a parking lot and have to go to the parking lot standards?
Oh, sure. If somebody actually goes through the process of building a new parking lot, it has to meet all the new parking lot construction standards.
And is there a buffer or a setback from adjacent residential zones?
5 feet.
It's not much.
Joe, can I just clarify something? I've got 70% in my head because that's the number of people in your survey that have a car.
Correct.
Is 60% was the number of current market rate units that are paired with a parking unit?
Correct. Over the last 6 years, if you look at all the permits, all the units that have been built over the last 6 years, 65% of them have been in buildings where parking has been provided.
At a ratio of
When you look at sort of how that averages out across all those buildings, the average ratio is almost one per space.
So whether we
are bigger, some are smaller.
So whether we take the BPS proposal or the tiered approach, we're still setting a minimum well below what at least 65% of the market is providing.
You're affecting the what would that be, the 35% that currently is built without parking. You're affecting a subset of that. And our concern about the whole discussion of creating options is that after we put this minimum in, is there still enough of that supply of building without parking to still offer that option as part of one of the ways you can live in Portland?
But to the tiered approach, which we set, you helped us walk through this particular approach, one of the concerns that I expressed to you was if you set a 41-unit floor, you're saying to someone who comes in and says, I'll do my building at 40, I'm exempt altogether. So we went,
that could absolutely happen.
And we were kind of maybe creating a perverse incentive to do that. So we dropped it from 1 to 4 to 1 to 5 because of the diagrams you showed us that said that, in fact, in buildings that size, you can accommodate the parking at the 1 to 5 ratio. It would be a hardship at 1 to 4.
Yes, there's two really bad outcomes that could potentially happen from two different alternatives. Really bad, you judge. One is, if you set it at 41 and above, you could see a lot of 39, 40-unit buildings, right? And people are concerned that the whole world will become 39 and 40-unit buildings. The average size of building that was built over the last 6 years that provided parking was 41 units, but that's just an average number. So you could have that result. There's nothing in our PSC recommended code that would prevent that. But there's this other prospect that's out there that you could end up with from this cohort of 31 to 40-unit buildings with a bunch of curb cuts down our commercial streets. And I can't tell you that won't happen either. So that's what I mean. It's sort of two possibilities. Has the market done this yet with the curb cuts? There is some of that going on. It hasn't been widespread, but there has been some. We don't see many buildings in the 30 to 40 unit size over the last 6 years. I can't tell you that that's permanent sort of condition, but that's been the trend. So does that help mediate the risk of the 39 unit building? Maybe. But every time we set a threshold, Commissioner, somebody figures out a business model will come in right underneath it, no matter where you set it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I have just one more question. The parking minimums are adjustable, is that correct?
Correct.
So somebody could come in and ask for an adjustment review and go down to zero if they prove their case that they've met the purpose statement.
And the purpose statement show that they've mitigated for impacts and that they're in conformance with the street classifications and the desired character of the area.
So that might be another way that even now, before we get to shared parking, that somebody could come in and say that they've got another lot that's allowed to have parking, and they could get an adjustment on the first one, potentially.
Potentially.
It would be a discretionary review, and so nobody would be making promises, but yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Susan?
I'd be remiss if I didn't say this. So at the Planning and Sustainability Commission, one of the things that kept coming up was the desire, and I think you heard it here too, to look at parking management, and that we realized we were directed to begin to move quickly on this, but that they really saw that going hand in hand and that there were many opportunities to both use traditional mechanisms that haven't been used maybe as much as could be in terms of the pilot area program, but also beginning to look at the things like you talked about, Parking Panda and these other things that other cities, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., other places are looking at that wouldn't be hard to fix in terms of changing code in terms of making it an allowable use to rent out your driveway. It's no different than what we did.
Can I offer you one cautionary note? As the author of the legislation which proposed allowing someone to, a homeless family to sleep in their car in a church parking lot,
right.
I would not underestimate the reaction in neighborhoods across the city to the idea that the parking space next to their home is being leased out to a total stranger for a commercial purpose. And I just... we learned a lot through that debate, and concept sounds like a wonderful idea of managing inventory, but my guess is it's going to people are going to have some very strong feelings in the neighborhoods about that concept.
Nevertheless, it would be a good topic to look at in the comp plan.
It was hard to look at allowing neighbors to have buying clubs at their houses too when we did the food issue, and we got through that. But it didn't happen in 2 months. You know, it took 6 months of getting everybody to a point where they could agree on something, and it could take longer.
Okay, further questions for staff before we take up amendments? And maybe if we could put the list back up on the screen. I know we have it in front of us here, but I assume people would like to take those in order based on the order in which they were proposed, and then the amendment regarding historic buildings will have to wait until next week because it will arrive in formal and paper form by then.
Mayor, do we have... could we have the sponsor of each amendment just summarize again the rationale before the vote?
And on number one, I believe that would be you.
What's left of my brain. We have moved and seconded the tiered approach. Appreciate very much the discussion here today. I think this has been one of the most interesting and informative hearings we've had on any subject in a long time. The purpose of the tiered approach is to prevent a market overcorrection, which would be people choosing to do a slightly smaller building below 40 to get out from parking altogether. It is tiered based on feedback we've received from people across the spectrum about how this might work best. And it is, at least at the high end, designed to capture the notion that the cumulative effect through either multiplication of these buildings in a certain area or the size of any particular building has a different impact on a neighborhood than the smaller building. So the tiered tries to balance a number of values building on a thoughtful proposal from BPS, but essentially tweaking it to incorporate a few more values that were brought to our attention through this process.
Okay, roll call on amendment number one.
Fish.
Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, it's been a long hearing. I guess I'm going to sort of state at the outset. I've heard a lot of concerns raised about affordability, about livability, about compact urban design, sort of a lot of things that we in Portland hold dear, that we have since 1970 anyway, since we adopted massive statewide land use laws. And this is a complicated area, and I think this is an area where I'm basically going to toe the line with the Planning and Sustainability Commission. They've devoted a lot of time to this. I don't feel like I'm smart enough to tell whether the tiered approach really makes that big a difference in the scheme of things. I mean, I know this issue is before us because of political pressure from neighbors who woke up and found units going in with zero parking and became concerned about it. And that has worked itself through this process, and it has resulted in an expedited request from the City Council to the Planning Sustainability Commission to wrestle with this, and they've done that. And I think, by and large, almost unanimously, they have come up with these recommendations. And I don't feel I'm in a position to really second-guess those, and some of the second-guessing I would do would come at the impact to me of questions about, are we making things less affordable? And are we affecting ultimate livability for this city and providing people choices? And I think the statistic that Joe just threw out, that this really affects 35% of the market. 65% of the market is still being built with ample parking. And I think we tend to overlook things like car share and our climate action plan, all these things that are important to us and have changed perhaps the dynamic of how people get to and from work, how they get to and from a store, or the fact that, Division Street, when I was growing up here, Division Street was just basically a bowling alley. You could throw a ball down there and nothing would happen. And now it's a great place. I think, as Councillor Stacy said, it's nice to be able to walk a block and have a place to eat, to shop, get a cup of coffee. And those options, not to pick on any particular corridor, but Division Street, frankly, is why we're here tonight. That has become a dramatically different place. It's the engine for growth in this city right now. It's what, Northwest 23rd used to be in terms of the dynamic that's going on there. And so I think that I'm going to just leave it at that. The Planning Sustainability Commission, I think, did a good job. I feel it strikes the right balance, or at least as good a balance as I'm able to figure out at this hour of the night. So I'm going to, with all due respect, vote no.
Novick?
I first have sort of a procedural question as the new guy. I'm contemplating potentially offering an amendment to Commissioner Fish's amendment. Could I offer that after this vote?
Well, I might get procedural help on that, since I believe we have to have these in printed form in order to be able to take action on them.
Correct. And I don't believe you can amend a motion while it's being voted on.
So is the alternative? Vote yes and then move to reconsider?
Yeah. Whoever's on the losing side could vote to reconsider.
What's that?
Who's on the losing side?
I could make a motion to reconsider, I guess.
Which way does he have to vote in order to be able to reconsider?
It'd have been prevailing.
No.
All right. I don't really want to vote no, but can I offer an additional amendment in another 20 minutes?
Why don't you vote no, and we'll bring and then move to reconsider, and we'll take up your amendment.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I thought, point of order. I thought you had to be on the prevailing side to do a motion to reconsider.
I thought that too.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're correct, Commissioner Saltzman. I was anticipating the vote. Whoever's on the prevailing side can move to reconsider, not the losing side.
I'm anticipating I'm on the
even
not
better,
the prevailing
even
side.
Better, Steve. Okay. Even better. And I will join you in that effort.
In that case, I vote aye.
Fritz, people think this is dull.
Yeah.
Democracy in action, aye. Hales.
Let me make some comments about the big picture first. We've heard some great testimony today, some very passionate testimony. I'm going to sound a little cavalier when I say this, but I'm pretty sure that even in making these adjustments, we still haven't gotten it right. And I say that with all affection and respect for everybody that's worked on this issue, including those of us who are working on it right now. And that is, I think we did have a vision of a certain pattern and form of development that would happen along these main streets as a result of the zoning and policies and regulations that we put in place, and now we have to adjust. That doesn't mean that we're not sticking to the vision, doesn't mean that we're not becoming a very transit and pedestrian and bicycle-oriented city that is moving away from dependence on the car, doesn't mean those things. But it does mean we have to make adjustments so that we get in practice what we hoped for in theory. I tell the story sometimes about the original action on the mixed-use zoning designation, which I think a few people still remember, wherein it didn't work at all because we made a mistake in the construction of the mathematics for the zoning designation, because it turns out that no second floor is ever quite the same size as the first floor because there has to be a hole for the staircase. And we got that one wrong by a few percent. And so I'm not sure if these amendments that we're going to adopt, I think we are, will tune the performance of our zoning code in exactly the way that at least most of us are hoping for. And that's why we do periodic review, and that's why we change our comp plan and we change our regulations from time to time. So, like it or not, I don't think we're done with this subject. But I do think it's now time to make an adjustment, that we have to live in the present day while we're working for change. And the fact that we're having this much discord among people who all believe in the same objective means it's time to make that adjustment. So I'm going to support a package here that I think will work better. It will work for a while. And unfortunately, like it or not, we'll probably have to adjust it again. So I hope you did like this hearing in that sense. Aye. Okay. Yeah.
Would it be okay for me to ask for a discussion before I move to reconsider?
That's fine. I'll certainly
accommodate
that.
So I, as you can tell, am a bit worried that we might result in 35-unit buildings with mid-block with curb cuts if we wind up not giving these 30 to 40-unit buildings the opportunity to buy off-site parking. Commissioner Fritz makes a strong case that that might result in locking in surface parking. I still have a mind to introduce an amendment allowing off-site parking for these buildings, these limited places, but I could be persuaded that that would just be throwing a wrench into the monkey, and what we should do is have a broader discussion about off-site parking and maybe bring that whole issue back. So I seek comments from my better experienced colleagues.
What I would suggest in that situation is it would either, I tend to defer to Rick Michelson, who's done a lot of infill development and who served on the Planning Commission for many years. So his advice that indeed it wouldn't result in the horrible curb cuts is persuasive to me. But the other piece that's in this package is that we're allowing buy down to 50% with various other options. Then for the 50% of the parking that's then left, the developer can apply for an adjustment and prove that their proposal equally or better meets the purpose of the code. So they actually could, in that instance, come into a discretionary review and prove, and the neighbors would get to comment on whether, in fact, they'd prefer to have no on-site parking and no curb cuts. So there is a process to do that. Rather than for, because the planning staff were asked, could you craft an amendment which said, except for on mid-block? And they've spent quite some time over the last several weeks looking at that, and to date have not come up with a refinement for that. So then you're looking at, are you going to exempt all 30s to 40s, even if they're on a corner when it might be very easy to provide tuck-under parking?
And yes, I mean, given the difficulty of just regulating mid-block, I would have proposed that it be 31 to 40 units, except that the minimum number in those places may be located in parking areas whose closest point is within 500 feet. Any thoughts from the other commissioners on this topic?
Steve, I appreciate what you're trying to accomplish, and particularly because I think we want to avoid lots of mid-block curb cuts for many of the reasons that people testified. We don't want people having to sort of walking their kids or older adults or people with other impairments having to dodge cars. But Joe, you're
oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just.
You look like you're about to jump in with something. So.
Well, no, I just wanted to offer this up that we could craft, if the intent after this discussion is to try to use the adjustment process as a way where a community with a developer can come in and say, we'll live with no parking for that building because we don't want that curb cut. We would need to, it would be valuable to put something in the purpose statement that says we care about the pedestrian realm and are willing to trade off parking for the avoiding the damage that a curb cut might do. Because that gives the adjustment officer a leg to make a finding like that if it has community support. And if it doesn't have community support, then you're in a whole different pickle, but that's part of what that process is about. That could be a possibility. We did look at trying to figure out how to regulate mid-block versus corners, and you would have to give us more time because there's lots of ways to get out. It gets complicated pretty fast once you get in there. Although I think, we're the PS, the Planning and Sustainability Commission supported off-site parking, so anything that moves in that direction, I think, is consistent with what they thought, too. So.
Mayor, do you have a thought?
I like Joe's suggestion. I think anything that incents the parties to these projects to negotiate against a set of goals is more likely to get to a better result, for example, keeping storefront retail in a situation like one that we've been looking at lately. So not every project needs to be negotiated, but where negotiation is the route to adjustment, I'm more confident in that. So I like Joe's suggestion and would support having them come back with revised purpose statement language that does that.
Mr. Fritz?
And Catherine, can we add that language next week, or does it need to be defined tonight?
First reading of that substitute ordinance with additional amendments, which means that you would either need to carry it over to another second reading, or you could adopt it next week with an emergency clause.
Okay.
So maybe the language could be something similar to in the purpose statement after the piece about especially those with disabilities, we could say, while respecting the pedestrian environment on the transit street sidewalk.
You know,
is that what you were thinking along?
Yeah,
the lines,
and actually,
Joe?
What I would really like to do is go talk with BDS, whose officers have
there.
To apply the language to
yeah,
nail it. Let's nail it.
Okay.
Thank you. Let's see if we can do it tonight.
All right. So then, let's unless you want to move your substitute, we'll move on to number two. And. Commissioner Fritz, would you like to?
This is clarifying where these parking standards apply and also setting the distance to be 1,500 feet from transit stations from the max stop.
Commissioner Fritz, are we voting on this as a package to A, B, C, and D?
Correct.
Further discussion? Roll call on amendment number 2.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
No.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Okay, item 3.
This is setting a minimum of 50% of the required parking so that you couldn't adjust below that. You couldn't get exemptions below that or substitutions.
Mm-hmm. Except by the adjustment.
Except by the adjustment.
Except by
process,
adjustment,
right?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay, further discussion? Roll call.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
No.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye. Approved. And item 4, off-site.
It's about the off-site piece, and I appreciate the discussion. It's something, obviously, that I feel very passionately about, that we don't. Surface parking lots, to me, are the worst waste of space in our entire city, and that if we can have residential development, mixed-use development, anything other than single-use surface parking lot, it seems to me that that is the better thing. The other point to this is that by requiring some on-site parking, it makes sure that the people with disabilities, those with small children and lots of groceries to schlep inside, are actually right there, that the parking is there. And it looks at the carrying capacity of the lot as to how much land is there and how many uses can fit on that land, including all of the things that the people who live there may want to do in their lives. So not all of them, but certainly in their residential capacity. So that's why I believe strongly that the residential parking should be located on the same site.
Commissioner Fritz, we're now just voting on 4A, correct?
Correct. Well, it's the same.
But there's a 4B and a 4C.
Yeah, and 4B actually is about joint-use parking, and Matt and I were just discussing it. This just allows whatever parking is provided, so even if it's provided on-site, to be joint-use, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so it adds a little flexibility, like you were talking earlier about the... So we originally, I think, thought the two of them had to go together, but they can be considered separately. Joint use is different than offsite.
Yeah, let's take them up separately then.
Sorry, I was using the long
sheet. So are you saying that to keep the current code that allows joint use parking, we still have to amend the draft?
We have to amend the Planning Commission's recommendation.
Oh, that's right. Okay. All right, let's take 4A then, which is the 500 feet.
To delete the language that allows parking to be within 500 feet.
Right.
Correct.
Further discussion, roll call.
So is this 4A?
4A.
4A. Okay.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
No.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye.
I'm going to need a little more hand-holding on 4B. I'm just a little,
yeah.
It's the hour,
so,
and I'm a little
yeah,
confused.
Walk us through 4B in part because of the way this describes it. Well,
4B is about provisions that allow joint-use parking. So when you have... parking that's meeting your requirement, that it can be used for multiple uses other than just the dedicated use that's meeting the requirement. But what you have to prove is this, that, for instance, residential parking that during the day might be able to be leased to employees of shops on the commercial district. That's joint-use parking. You have to do a study that proves that the parking demand for the use that you're applying it to meet the required parking provisions for the time overlap really works. So that's what joint use parking is about.
Is that a sufficient, in your judgment, protection from someone kind of gaming the system? Because we want to make sure that it's put to the primary purpose, but then take advantage of full utilization.
Well, I think, and I want Matt to weigh in on this. If we have said you have to meet your parking on site, then you don't have the issue that Commissioner Fritz was worried about with the surface lots and other, it's got to be on site. It just allows a more flexible use of the parking on site. Is that correct?
Well, if residential parking has to be located on site, then the joint use parking in the narrow term, would really be encouraging more parking to be built with new apartments, so then they could have joint use agreements with nearby commercial uses.
What about the case of complying with the minimum and having excess capacity? Does this make it easier for someone to